This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
My name is Jeff Dolvin. This is my good colleague and beloved friend, Graham Burnett. Will tell us a little bit about the mechanics, about how we'll begin.
So you've already begun to seat yourselves, but this will be an opportunity to think about how you might want to refigure yourself. The evening is going to run about like this. Jeff and I, up front, after giving you guys a little sense of what's going to happen at these tables, we'll read a few of the poems to kind of bring in the spirit, bring in the light, and then you'll turn to the exercise at hand. I'm going to give you a little like tipping open of that exercise so we can get ourselves settled for the opening kind of reading part of things. On this table, you will find 12 poems of innocence. In other words, poems from the innocence cycle. On this table, you'll find 12 poems of experience, poems from the experience cycle. Before this evening's finished, you're going to sit opposite in opposition is true friendship kind of situation. And in a series of sequential abscisions, remove word by word each of the words from the poem between you. We'll go over this, but it's to say you're going to take the poem that's between you down to an empty slate. You're going to save those words, placing them in the bowl, and then you will reconstitute that poem, not as a song of innocence, if you're at this table, but as a song of experience, using the same words, each and every one of them. And if you're at this table, you'll take a poem that is a song of experience, and you will refigure it as a song of innocence. So what you now need to do, just to be ready for the evening, is one, choose, select, encounter your opposite, that is, the person across from whom you'll sit and with whom you'll work, in a chess-like fashion to decreate and remake this poem. And then you'll probably want to choose whether you're more inclined to turn a song of innocence into a song of experience, in which case you should be on this side of the room, or whether your inclinations and your habits lead you to be a reconstitutor of that which has been lost, transformed, exposed, depraved, in which case you might wish to be at this table so that you can try to bring innocence to that which has been experienced. So I'm going to stop there for a minute and let you assert yourselves. If you're not opposite a human and there isn't a poem between you, then you can't do what we'll do over the next hour and a half or so this evening. So that's where you want to be. You want to be opposite someone with whom you want to work this evening. Experience. Innocence. You have one between you. Going. Is everybody set up? Everybody have an opposite? We'll find you. Okay. So with that, let me hand things back to Jeff Dolvin, who will start us off by just reminding us a little bit about the character, the life, and the times of William Blake. Jeff.
So very briefly, William Blake, 1757 to 1827, relatively modest birth. He was the son of a hosier, grew up in London, spent almost all of his life there. Talent for drawing when he was young. His parents indulged him in lessons. A talent also for reading, and the Bible was always around. His parents baptized him, though they were dissenters, his dissenting religion, important to what will follow. He becomes an apprentice to an engraver, and engraving, about which Graham will have a few words to say, really becomes his trade and his the artistic medium for which we know him best now. He also spends a certain amount of time at the Royal Academy of Art. He has a school education. He has a practical education. He's in the forefront of the Gordon riots in 1810 when the Newgate prison is torn down and everyone inside is liberated. Not long after that, he begins to experiment in the methods of engraving for which we know him best. And I have my dates wrong, not 1810, forgive me for the Gordon riots, but 1780. Apologies for that. 1789, a year that may have some significance for all of you, some historical significance, he starts to work on these Songs of Innocence, the first suite of 19 poems. And they're engraved, as we'll see, on plates, which means that he can shift their order around. The poems themselves, the text, see, never changes because they're fixed in the engravings, but the order shifts. 1793, as things are beginning to go bad in France, or have been going bad in France, he writes the Songs of Experience, a new set of plates, and shortly thereafter starts to make books that combine the two as the Songs of Innocence and Experience. I think it's important to our exercise that a certain number of plates travel back and forth between those two books. Sometimes he thinks of them as Songs of Innocence, and sometimes he thinks of them as Songs of Experience. About that technique of engraving by which this book, The Songs of Innocence and Experience, was made, I turn to Graham to tell you.
So Jeff's told us that some of the poems move back and forth, and it's quite possible some of you are lifelong experts in Blake, and we won't attempt to supersede on that expertise, but it's, I think, right to say that Blake was something of a madman in certain ways, and in that madness one detects an appetite for those kinds of translations, quite radical, even sort of dialectical. The idea that you could go from innocence to experience or experience to innocence tips open for us some of the spirit of willful transmutation that's going to be in the poetry and in the spirit of the exercise this evening. And I'll read a line about the printing technique that also informs the kind of exercise that we'll try to do this evening, and go from there. So this is from The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. But the notion that man has a body distinct from his soul is to be expunged. This I shall do by printing in the infernal method, by corrosives, which in hell are salutary and medicinal, melting apparent surfaces away and displaying the infinite which was hid. So printing by the infernal method, are there printers? There must be lots of printers in the room. So he trained as an engraver, meaning he cut plates, mostly copper plates. In intaglio printing, of which engraving is a species, the ink sits in the cut lines and is transferred to the paper, sucks the ink out. The paper, in a sense, sucks the ink out of the cut lines. The technique that, the quite controversial and unusual technique that Blake deployed is relief etching. in which, in the contrary, the ink sets up on the surface of the areas to be printed. And the way he did that was by painting on the plate with a resist and then bathing the plates in acid. So those of you who've done intaglio printing like Aquatint, it's a little bit like that. Only here, you would use sufficient acid to cut out everything that wasn't written on with the resist, leaving you with a raised plate, a little bit like a set type plate. So that much space, in a sense, between what you dug out by the acid and where you had the ink sitting up. And so while it's interesting to think, and there's a huge amount of technical scholarship on how he actually managed to combine the images and the text and all that kind of stuff, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this. This isn't that class. What is really striking is in that moment, the kind of extravagant allegory that is so immediately present for him in the act of making the plates this way. The acid, the cutting, negating stuff of hell, is going to here be, in a sense, forced to do creative work by excising that which brings what must be into being. So in that gesture of negating comes the kind of dialectical emergence of that which must obtain. And we, in the work of excision this evening, are going to work materially with the text in a process of sort of seeking that infinite, which he talks about here, that lovely phrase. The infernal can melt surfaces away, melt apparent surfaces away in corrosives, and display the infinite which was hid. That's our job. That's a quote from Blake.
That's from The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which was written right around the same time as the Experience songs.
So to get us going, we'll read some of the poems.
Yeah, so we'll just read six poems, say a sentence or two about each of them, and part of the idea of that will be to give us all some resources for thinking about the difference between and some of the similarities between innocence and experience for Blake as we turn to our own making. One of the things that we'll come up with, this is the Innocence Table. At the end of the night, we will have a suite of new songs of experience here, and here a suite of new songs of innocence. The first poem I'll read is called Spring. The title page, showing the two contrary states of the human soul. And Blake, innocence and experience, he's such a reader of the Bible, he's such a reader of Milton. Milton, for whom the transition from innocence to experience is a historical event. It's the moment when Eve partakes of the apple and everything changes. For Blake, a typical and even a prototypical romantic, this is an event in human life. It happens somewhere between infancy and who you are now. And there are things to be learned from the children that populate these poems. This one is called Spring. Sound the flute, now it's mute. Birds delight, day and night, nightingale in the dale, lark in sky, merrily, merrily, merrily to welcome in the year. Little boy full of joy, little girl sweet and small, cock does crow, so do you, merry voice, infant noise, merrily, merrily to welcome in the year. Could you give us the next line? To end the poem, little lamb, here I am, come and lick my white neck. Let me pull your soft wool. Let me kiss your soft face. Merrily, merrily, we welcome in the year. I defy our critical intelligence to prize out of this song anything fallen, anything skeptical, anything subversive, as we experience, citizens of experience, so love to do. It has Blake's investment in childhood. It has his simple rhythms. And it has an encounter with a lamb who is always, for Blake, a figure of Christ in the language of childhood, with no betrayal of doctrine, right? And there's no sense in which to have the lamb lick your face is knowing anything less about Christ than reading the Gospel of Mark.
A song of experience. And I'll read a cradle song. And this won't be the text of the cradle song I'll read, because the cradle song I'll read is one of those texts that was filed, in a sense, for a period of time under the one, then under the other. We don't have a slide. I don't think a plate for this version of A Cradle Song was done. Sleep, sleep, beauty bright, dreaming in the joys of night. Sleep, sleep, in thy sleep, little sorrows sit and weep. Sweet babe, in thy face, soft desires I can trace, secret joys and secret smiles, little pretty infant wiles. As thy softest limbs I feel, smiles as of the morning steal o'er thy cheek and o'er thy breast, where thy little heart doth rest. Oh, the cunning wiles that creep in thy little heart asleep. When thy little heart doth wake, then the dreadful light shall break. So, a similar moment over the crib, but very differently configured. And I think the thing to say here is experience is always a training to see in reverse. So here you have this paradigmatic moment of innocence, but experience is a kind of spiritual exercise of being able to see the coruscating, roiling, imminent evil in a scene of quintessential innocence, and, by contrast, an ability to see innocence in the actual flaming eruption of a satanic form. So what you are as experience is capable of training yourself to a reversible sight that sees what is apparently innocent as cruel and evil, and what is apparently full of darkness as scintillating. And by that spiritual exercise, you accede to a kind of antinomian transcendence, where you can see all the evils as goods and all the goods as evil, and you're kind of, in some sense, out of that game. You can affirm all the negations and negate all the affirmations, both at the same time.
Another song of innocence. The Chimney Sweeper. When my mother died, I was very young, and my father sold me while yet my tongue could scarcely cry, weep, 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 weep. So your chimneys I sweep, and in soot I sleep. There's little Tom Dacre who cried when his head that curled like a lamb's back was shaved. So I said, hush, Tom, never mind it, for when your head's bare, you know that the soot cannot spoil your white hair. And so he was quiet, and that very night, as Tom was a-sleeping, he had such a sight that thousands of sweepers, Dick, Joe, Ned, and Jack, were all of them locked up in coffins of black. And by came an angel who had a bright key, and he opened the coffins and set them all free. Then down a green plain, laughing, they ran and wash in river and run and wash in a river and shine in the sun. Then, naked and white, all their bags left behind, they rise upon clouds and sport in the wind. And the angel told Tom if he'd be a good boy, he'd have God for his father and never want joy. And so Tom awoke, and we rose in the dark and got with our bags and our brushes to work. Though the morning was cold, Tom was happy and warm. So if all do their duty, they need not fear harm. And it's just that last line that I'll touch on. Is that last line a rebuke to us? That is, are we being confronted there with the sort of moral that we would apply to this situation, as though all of this religious consolation were only a way of us getting our servants back to work? Is this, on the other hand, the obdurate innocence of this chimney sweep who can make an innocent motto out of our most depraved circumstances? This is Blake, the ironist, another note that we might think about. And also Blake with an idea of innocence that is like the idea of experience that Graham articulated a moment ago, maybe a little bit double. Maybe it has a relationship to false consciousness.
A Song of Experience, the nurse's song. When the voices of children are heard on the green and whisperings are in the dale, the days of my youth rise fresh in my mind. My face turns green and pale. Then come home, my children. The sun has gone down, and the dews of night arise. Your spring and your day are wasted in play, and your winter and night in disguise. And the thing to offer on this poem is the sense of experience in the form of the nurse, in a sense, standing on the threshold and calling the children in. And that image of experience on the threshold, I think, could be with us. I talked before about the kind of reversible inversions of the first poem. And here, a sense that experience is Janus-faced on the threshold. The songs of afternoon, the children playing, remind her of the past, and push her mind forward to the children's future. Experience is Janus-faced and always on the threshold.
One more, Song of Innocence. The Divine Image, this is a great one. Deep Blake. To mercy, pity, peace, and love, all pray, he speaks to us, all pray in their distress, and to these virtues of delight return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God our Father dear, and mercy, pity, peace, and love is man, his child and care. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form, in heathen, Turk, or Jew, where mercy, love, and pity dwell, there God is dwelling too. Watch what Blake does for us. He begins by saying, you pray to mercy, pity, peace, and love, right? Well, no, I pray to God, but wait, that's what God is. So have I your assent? That these are the qualities to which you pray, yes? Well then, how do you know mercy, pity, peace, and love? Well, we know it among ourselves. This is Blake the pragmatist. We know it because we see it in other people's faces, because we see it in other people's forms. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face. How else would we know it? And by the end of the poem, somehow we are not made in the image of God, but God is made in our image, and that is the whole of his divinity.
And finally, A Song of Experience, the human abstract. And this poem has some of the same preoccupations with divine qualities, pity, peace. Pity would be no more if we did not make somebody poor, and mercy no more could be if all were as happy as we. And mutual fear brings peace, till the selfish loves increase. Then cruelty knits a snare and spreads his baits with care. He sits down with holy fears and waters the ground with tears. Then humility takes its root underneath his foot. Soon spreads the dismal shade of mystery over his head, and the caterpillar and the fly feed on the mystery. And it bears the fruit of deceit, ruddy and sweet to eat, and the raven his nest has made in its thickest shade. The gods of the earth and sea sought through nature to find this tree, but their search was all in vain. There grows one in the human brain. And there's a lot to say here, but that's not what I'm up for. Just to call out one thing, which is the place of mystery in this poem. The foliage, the shade of this tree is mystery. What happens in the space of mystery? Death, the raven, builds its dwelling. And the fruit of this tree is deceit. if in Christendom there's an emphasis on organizing everything around mystery, mystery as the kind of holy of holies, the sanctum, organizes space, it is part of that antinomian commitment to a
time.
Leveling and an absence of any of such structurings that there can be no mystery. So experience will not have truck with mystery. Experience will not have truck with mystery. Jeff, tell us what we're going to do.
We have instructions, which we will hand out. Enough to pass down the outside of this table and the outside of this.
And what you're getting is also right up here.
So let me take you through the first half of the exercise. Decreation, which for Blake is displaying the infinite which was hid. And if there's one thing that we want to understand ourselves as trying to do with the words that he's given us for this evening, it's displaying the infinite which was hid. Our first instruction is to be silent. And this is a silent exercise. So as you make each move, as we'll describe them, you cannot speak to one another. But you are aspiring to the unfallen state in which you understand what you want to do. You're recovering that original innocence that is a kind of intersubjective collaboration. So we're all fallen people here. Do the best you can, but that's the idea. All right? So be silent is the first instruction. Second instruction, with the knife, and you'll see you have one before you, each of you. The one, presumably the person for whom the poem is presently right side up, cuts one word from the poem and places the word in the bowl. You'll find that if you score the page, then you can tuck the blade underneath the word in question, lift it out, and put it in the bowl. And then the poem will remain with a hole. Rotate the sheet. The other, with the knife, cuts another word from the poem and places the word in the bowl. This continues until there is only one word, the last word. Okay? So it is an exercise in undoing a poem, but there's an injunction here to which we ask you to pay attention. Both participants are duly mindful that the removal of each word makes a new poem, so that each word that comes out of that poem leaves a different poem on the table. And one of the things that you're thinking about as you go is what poems are emerging from the poem Blake gave you, down to the final poem, which is the single word. That's decreation.
Next slide. And so when you've had a moment to shake that out, you'll start to remake the poem, a new poem. In silence, after the removal of the last word, you'll score the page into a frame. We'll show an image of it in just a second. So you'll have a void in which to work. And you'll see that the way the sheets have been prepared, that when you do that, the cardboard sheet, the board sheet underneath it, will still have a kind of matrix of wax on it. And one by one, alternating, you'll place one word at a time in that space, back and forth, until you've used all the words. Again, mindful that the addition of each new word, in whatever location it ends up, makes a new poem. Now, this is, you might at some point feel that you've found the song of innocence that was latent in your song of experience. That is, you might put down the word and be like, my God, it's done. How could you indicate that you want to stop? Basically, what can happen is that you can play a word, you can make a gambit, in a sense, a little like a bridge bet, which is to place the word upside down, which is in a way of saying, you know, from my perspective, We're where we might want to stop, but you can't make the other person play that way. You can play all the rest of your plays upside down, but the other person can keep playing out his or her version of the latent poem within. So just to bear in mind that a word can be placed in the frame upside down if you wish, and that that's legible by your partner if he or she chooses to read that bid.
That is our exercise. At the end, oh yes, helpful illustrations before we pass to the activity itself. So a poem as it is before you. Next slide. A poem with all the words but one cut away, and you can see how they've been cut and prized. And then you cut the skeleton, as it were, of the poem out, so that you make yourselves a frame, like so. And then enter the words one by one in the way that we've described into that space. There is a blank one, as you can see.
And we'll have the option when we're done at that point. These can be just momentarily slipped into the infernal crucible, the cabinet oven in the kitchen. Which will be kept at 250 degrees, and a couple of moments in there will reset this, so it'll be back and stay just like that for all time, or until you leave it in the window.
So that's it. We are with William Blake. We are with his problem of innocence and experience, and the difference between them. You may know of his poem, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, printed around the same time. It's clear that Blake had a slight disposition towards the infernal, just as he thought Milton did, Milton, who was of the devil's party but did not know it. We have obliged Blake's infernal tendencies with infernal temperatures here to keep the wax pliable and to keep all of us thinking freely and in a Blakean fashion. But the good news is beer is available after and indeed throughout. Sage. We're now in the territory of your inspiration. When you are channeling Blake, you'll know what to do.